Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Texit. We had Blexit.
Brexit.
Well, we had Brexit, but we had Blexit. We had what was the gay exit from the Democrat Party?
Oh,
what do they call that? Glexit? Gay lesbian exit? I don't know. Now we have Texit. That's
what's Texit?
Tulsi Gabbard exiting the Democrat Party. She posted this yesterday. Did the former congresswoman and Democrat socialist candidate for president.
I can no longer remain in today's Democratic Party that's under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers who are driven by cowardly wokeness, who divide us by racializing every issue and stoking anti-white racism, who actively work to undermine our God-given freedoms that are enshrined in our Constitution, who are hostile to people of faith and spirituality, who demonize the police but protect criminals at the expense of law-abiding Americans, who believe in open borders, who weaponize the national security state to go after their political opponents, and above all, who are dragging us ever closer to nuclear war. Now, I believe in a government that's of the people, by the people, and for the people. Unfortunately, today's Democratic Party does not. Instead, it stands for a government that is of, by, and for the powerful elite. Now, I'm calling on my fellow common sense, independent-minded Democrats to join me in leaving the Democratic Party. If you can no longer stomach the direction that the so-called woke Democratic Party ideologues are taking our country, then I invite you to join me.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA. Turnkey.pro text line, what do you think of Tulsi Gabbard's sales pitch?
I don't know if anybody's going to join her, but I see why she left. I'm a recovering Democrat, and I know why I left, for pretty much the same reasons that she just said.
Post your own video.
Oh, should I?
Yeah.
But it's
yeah. Tulsi inspired
few years
you.
Later.
It's a little bit of a delayed reaction, yeah. But, you know, and get the whole pantsuit mafia together. You know, that maybe that's
I have to get a pantsuit
the
first.
The Texit. It could be all Texit. It could be all men and women wearing white pantsuits. For the men, it could be like the Don Johnson look. For the women, it could be the Tulsi Gabbard look. What do you think? It's interesting, too, because I mean,
we all saw this coming.
Well, I understand. Oh, she's on Tucker Carlson. So she's, you know, become some right wing extremist, as they would say. She's an insurrectionist. Well, she's a Putin asset, according to Hillary Clinton.
Oh, that's right. Remember?
That probably didn't sit too well with her when that was said. The interesting thing about Gabbard, you know, which is why I was like such a skeptic when people were so excited about her. I mean, like people on the center right excited about her from her performance during the presidential debates is, I mean, that she's a socialist on economic issues. It's not like she's some free marketeer. She's some throwback Scoop Jackson Democrat, a relic of a bygone era. I mean, on a lot of issues, she is right with the Dem Socialists. But on some of the important cultural issues, as you just heard her describe, she's not. And that makes all the difference.
They care more about the criminal than the victim. That is the Democratic Party.
Well, I mean, right. And she posted a longer version of that on her Substack page, and it's sort of categories. The pro-war Democratic Party has led us to the brink of war. The Democratic Party rejects the rule of law. You heard her talking about that. Weaponizing the security state while undermining the rule of law. IRS used to target conservative groups during Obama. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of evidence to support her claim about the rejection of the rule of law by the Democrat socialists. Today's Democrat Party does not believe in our constitutionally protected right to free speech. Again, just a mountain of evidence there. Does not believe in our constitutionally protected right to freedom of religion. Does not believe in our constitutionally protected right to bear arms. Is a big brother undermining our civil liberties. These are categories where she develops a couple paragraphs on each. Racializes everything and blatantly foments anti-white racism. Is anti-woman. We're talking about trans. Is undermining families. Talking about parental rights. If you can no longer stomach the direction of the so-called woke Democrat Party ideologues, that the so-called woke party, Democrat Party ideologues are taking our country, I invite you to join me. Well, I'm all in for sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, spread the word. Ron in Salem, Wisconsin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. I think conservatives should caution jumping on the Gabby Tolster train right away. She's far from a conservative. Look at her voting record. It's far left.
Go ahead, Ron.
I just wanted to add one more thing, a little different subject. I've been listening to you guys for years, and that bumper music when you start is very annoying.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, my dad says so too. And if Harvey says so, then we need to change.
I'll have to update it. And we should update our bumper music. Do a little bit of,
something.
Put a fresh coat of paint on the show.
We should also take a new promo picture.
You're wearing an outfit,
I think, from the 80s.
I doubt
and
that.
My hair
it wasn't that long ago.
Updated.
I think we should. We should use our parents' graduation pictures.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys know my mom and his dad graduated. Prof Jacobson, they graduated high school together.
And black and white too.
I've got the picture. I should tweet.
Yeah,
that
with my dad's like black horn rimmed frames from the 1860s or whenever they went to high school.
What year did they graduate high school?
Like
we should know these
right
things.
I think Reconstruction was just beginning. Like so, the early 1870s.
Title IX
exactly
hadn't
sure.
passed yet. I know that. Sports for women back then.
With respect to Ronna Taylor, nobody's jumping on the Tulsi Gabbard bandwagon. You've got the bandwagons reversed. She may not become a rock-ribbed Republican, but she's leaving that party, and she's explaining why you should leave it too. Vote Libertarian, be an independent, vote based on the candidate, whatever you want to do, but you got to get away from these, as she calls them, woke ideologues. Absolutely. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to have Tulsi attack the Democrats. We need more of that. But, you know, just don't vote for her in any elected office, because she's, you know, all of her other policies are just as destructive as the other Democrat policies. But as long as she's attacking them, yeah, go for it. I love it. I love her when she's pointing out, especially from the inside, that it's about time they had enemies in their perimeter backstabbing them. You know, so there.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Mamie. Thank you, Dan, for taking my call. Hey, let me put this in a nutshell here. I've been telling these people, like there's some people around work, everything, that if she voted for Biden, everything, I said, hey, your party's been hijacked by socialists. How the heck can you continue to take and follow the Democrat Party? They're socialists and everything. And I rub it into her like that and tell them it. And I said, I don't even see how a single person could basically stick in with them. So here's the case. Tulsi Gabbard, she figured it out. Well, why stick in there with the socialists? She's not one of us, but she basically sees they're a rotten bunch of socialist people destroying our country, destroying our way of life, destroying our economy, destroying everything we ever had, our freedom, everything. So she's even running from them. That's the way I see it.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Well, again, Bill Buckley's famous admonition, you have to give people room to come over to your side. So there's room for Tulsi Gabbard to come over to our side, and maybe since she's moved so far away from the woke Democrat ideologues, she recognizes those individuals and that pernicious philosophy for who they are and what it is. Well, perhaps we could convince her that some of what she thinks is good economic policy or environmental policy is neither. You know, if she's inquisitive and thoughtful enough to reverse course on these other matters, so... You know, there's always the possibility that it continues.
Is she going to run for president?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know what lane she fits in. So I don't think there's much prospect of a Tulsi Gabbard presidency or even high office. But she has profile.
Yeah.
And she has a perspective, and she served our country honorably.
She
so
did.
Her opinion is valuable. And I'm thinking maybe we do my walk-up music for the bumper. Some sort of, we've got to make it our own, but some sort of stylized version of Spandau Ballet is true.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Have you been following this story? Mike Scott's been reporting on it. This imbroglio on the LA City Council that led to the resignation as City Council Chairman, not as a City Council Woman, though, of Nuri Martinez. Nuri Martinez, who's a council being, and two other Latino council beings, along with the Latino head of the Federation of Labor in L.A., are all under fire because of comments they made following the MLK Day parade in L.A. in 2017 that recently came to light, in which Martinez and the others, but mainly Martinez makes the comments and the others sort of make some additional comments and guffaw along. Racist comments about the adopted black son of a gay city councilman in L.A.
Who's white.
Yeah, you following all that?
Yes.
All right. So here's Nuri Martinez apologizing. I always like to start with the apology, and then we'll get to the actual comments so that you can see if they...
Are they really sad, or are they just sad that they got caught?
They have comport. So here's her statement yesterday as read by a KTLA reporter in L.A., which is a Nexstar station for those of you scoring at home.
As someone who believes deeply in the empowerment of communities of color, I recognize my comments undercut that goal. Going forward, reconciliation will be my priority. I've already reached out to many of my black colleagues and other black leaders to express my regret in order for us to heal. I ask for forgiveness from my colleagues and from the residents of the city that I love so much.
Let the healing begin.
This is us. You need to heal, woman.
Oh, healing. That's healing. One of those words, too. Everything is healing. I've done something wrong. You know what we need to do for the thing that I did wrong? Come together as a community so we can all heal.
Together.
Yeah.
As one.
Okay, here's some of what she said and disseminated.
Now, here's a portion of that leaked audio where Martinez made racist comments toward Councilman Mike Bonin and his adopted son. This was at an MLK parade.
It's like the oddest thing. It's like black and brown on this floor. The kid is bouncing off the effing walls on the floor, practically tipping it over. There's nothing you can do to control him. That is a changuito. This kid needs a beat down. Like, let me take him around the corner, and then I'll bring him back.
And she used a Spanish word for monkey in describing him. So that was part of the rub. And then there's this 2021 incident as well.
Oh, there's
It's all coming out.
during a meeting in 2021 with other top Latino members of city council, as well as a high-ranking county labor leader, making derogatory and racist remarks about colleagues, namely L.A. County D.A. George Gascon, using an expletive and saying he's with the blacks. The conversation focused mainly on frustration with maps that were proposed for redistricting and concerns over loss of economic assets in current districts.
So the combination of the two has led to the
resignation.
Yeah, the calls for her. Well, her resignation as city council president, but not from her seat. And the calls for her resignation. Ron Herrera, the L.A. County Federation of Labor president, he has resigned. The other two Latino council members, along with Nuri Martinez, have yet to resign. Another councilman, Mitchell Farrow, does what you would expect from an identitarian leftist. He's broken over the comments.
I think that this is a moment of reconciliation for all of us. What we do when no one is looking is the definition of integrity. And this is a violation of that meaning. It's a violation of the trust that we've all given our colleagues. And it's just a really sad...
Keep it together, Mitchell.
It's a devastating
together,
day for
Mitchell.
Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's a devastating day for Los Angeles. No, it's a devastating day for you guys because you got caught because you're racists.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad. It's not. This is not a community thing.
They had a candlelight vigil.
No, they did not.
Of course they did. Outside on the steps outside the council chambers. That they absolutely did. And Councilman Mike Bonin, whose son was the target of those comments that you heard from Nuri Martinez, the council president. He went on local talk radio there. Tavis Smiley. I don't know if Tavis Smiley still had a show. Apparently he's got a radio program in L.A., maybe nationally syndicated. I don't know. But here's what Mike Bonin, the father of the boy in question, had to say about the whole matter.
Councilman Mike Bonin, whose black son is at the center of the controversy, expressing his hurt and anger on KBLA Talk Radio with Travis Smiley.
Today, I'm even angrier than I was yesterday. I'm quaking with anger. It's everything that is ugly and broken in politics, and they all must resign. Calling my son a monkey from Nuri, referring to him as a handbag from Kevin, as a lawn jockey from the head of the Labor Federation. What they said wasn't just ugly. It was joyfully ugly. Mm-hmm. They were enjoying themselves in this hate and in this racism. And they have shown that they are unfit to represent and speak for
the people of L.A. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think? What do you think about this? Is this the outrage proportional? Does it belie anything to you? Or is this all sort of straightforward, intemperate comments were made, people need to pay for those intemperate comments? Simple, open, and shut case. What do you think? Any politics here that may be of interest?
They're all Democrats.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're all Democrats, which means they're all identitarians.
They're all Latinos.
Latinos. You have now the black city council members, of course, echoing a bond in statements, calling for their resignation. I just wonder how this is received by people who live in one of the most racially polarized cities in America, most segregated cities in America, that would be Chicago, and who have watched the identitarian politics, the racial identitarian politics, play out over and over and again, and still are, with Lori Lightfoot, who spends a day where she won't talk to non-persons of color in the press corps, for example.
Yeah, her two-year anniversary. She thought that was the big, big idea.
Everything's racist, and everybody who disagrees with them is racist, right? So I just wonder how this is received. Oh, and by the way, it turns out that once you start playing that count-by-numbers racial game or that power struggle by racial group, what does it generate? A little bit of animus between the racial groups?
Yeah. You've taken us back 40 years.
Has anybody noticed the way that things are reported in the city? Who's going to be the Latino candidate for mayor? Who's going to be the black candidate for mayor? Who's going to be the white candidate for mayor? How many black candidates and then they split the vote? How many Latino candidates and then they split the vote? I mean, that's like water here. That's like Lake Michigan. You sort of don't forget it's there because it's just part of the tapestry. Isn't it? Latino this and black that and white this. And you may have heard, I don't think I'm speaking out of school here, there's a lot of political animus at the political level, not in everyday life, a lot of political animus between Latinos and blacks in the city.
Yeah.
Gee, where does that come from?
They're taking us back.
You think the politicians in Chicago are any better than the politicians in L.A.? You think the words that were used in 2017 and 2021 by Nuri Martinez and her friends there aren't used routinely in every direction in our racially polarized city where we play the game of counting by race? And who's the responsible party? The race hustlers, which is the Democrats. The cowards that won't speak with moral clarity on race, which is includes a lot of honkies and Republicans, who just let it go. So all this, oh, I should have said something, I should have stood up. And so many of those LA City Council members that are preening before the cameras now, hand-wringing and pearl-clutching, come on. They've never heard those words? Please, spare me.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And, you know, that reminded me of something, this whole contretemps in L.A. and holding someone to account for the things they said while in public office years ago. Was J.B. Pritzker ever held accountable for what he said on FBI wiretaps to Blago about black politicians in this city and state when they were discussing the appointment to the Senate seat held by Barack Obama after he had elevated himself to President of the United States?
He made some disparaging remark about Jesse White, I remember.
Here's J.B. Pritzker on former State Senate President Emil Jones.
Uh-oh. I mean, you know, he's just, I don't know how to say it exactly, but Emil's a little more crass.
Right.
Here's Emil Jones responding in 2018 to what was said by Pritzker in 2008. Because remember, this all came out in 2018 when Pritzker was running for governor. Was he held accountable? Is he being held accountable?
Do you believe he's a racist?
He says so. I didn't.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
He said so. I didn't. That's the other side of his face.
That's the other side of his face.
Ooh.
On Jesse White, J.B. Pritzker said this to Blago when he was positioning for an appointment to treasurer if Ali G got elevated to some post in D.C., including the prospect of the Senate seat. Maybe AG, that's interesting. We can play all those portions of the tape, too, so you understand what a craven social climber this do-nothing silver-spooned Spalding truly is. The other side of his face, said Emil Jones. JB on Jesse.
Of all the African Americans I can think that are sort of like qualified and people and vetted, and people will say, oh, that's, you know, that's a pretty good pick. The one I, you know, that is least offensive and maybe gets you the most because it gets you that Secretary of State appointment is Jesse White.
Least offensive black.
The
most, you know, sort of qualified because what, blacks can only be sort of qualified to be United States Senate? The United States Senator? Least offensive, the thing that doesn't offend, you know, him. The black person who doesn't offend him. Can't be too black. Is that what he's not saying? How would that comment be received if it was me saying it or if it was some other conservative saying it?
Oh, we'd be destroyed. Here's but he feels it and he thinks it.
Here's what Ninth Ward Alderman Tony Beal said at the time to that comment about Jesse White.
This is a slap in our face, taking our community for granted, playing our community against each other. This is not the kind of leadership that we need at this time.
We got it anyway. You going to keep it? What about it? What about all the black leadership now around the country? You had, and of course, all the elected officials, Garcetti, the mayor of L.A. has weighed in. Newsom has weighed in. Biden has weighed in. Does somebody want to weigh in on JB? No? Is that too far in the past? Well, what's the threshold? We're talking about L.A. City Council members who made comments 5 years ago. Well, these comments just came to light 4 years ago. What's the difference? Can't wait to hear this response to my questions. Philip in Blue Island.
You good.
I really am.
Because we have no friends as far as...
I'm your friend, Philip.
Yeah, okay, cool. You know, no, we have no friends when it comes to political people in politics. And even if they're black, sometimes they just, you know, accept their position and they don't really do anything, as you see, for a lot of black communities. So the fact that, you know, this thing is happening in Los Angeles and in Chicago, you're bringing out a lot of good sound bites and everything. But it's for us who are conscious, if you will. We know we don't have no friends, and so this stuff doesn't surprise me. But it doesn't help when you have I don't know what this congressperson name, he was at this Trump rally the other day, that's a Republican, saying that all blacks equate to criminals and reparations, that whole statement. It doesn't help the Republican Party when, you know, those type of things are coming out at the same time when you have this scandal in Los Angeles. So I don't know how you accept that, but it doesn't help.
Well, I just want to know if the black leadership, black voters, care about what J.B. Pritzker said.
Again, those who are conscious, we know. But again, that's why I'm saying it doesn't help when you have things like that happening. I don't know where this guy is, Phoenix or where he's at, you know, saying that black people want reparations because of the criminals. And no, this is just really idiotic, racist statements. So, you know, sometimes okay. It's the whole thing about the lesser of two evils, Dan. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Philip. Appreciate it.
That's a nice conversation.
Yeah. Philip and I get along sometimes. I'm trying to be his friend.
He wore a 1916 hat on the John Anthony's boat. 1619.
Oh, yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah.
1916 was a wonderful year.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's when our parents graduated from high school.
Yeah, right. Tony Roselle.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great opportunity to watch this sort of nonsense unfold, the hypocrisy unfold in real time. Had this been a straight white cis male out there on that city council, they would have burned his house. He might have been physically injured in the protests afterwards. But now we get to watch them wriggle and squirm and devour each other and call for unity and healing as a community. Had it been someone else, the results would have been far, far different.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
It's disgusting. Yes.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I mean, again, you know, the lesser of two evils argument. No, you know, we know. Well, and then you say, well, we're going to hold somebody to account. I mean, how do you, the lesser of two evils? I don't really understand that argument, because if you don't hold somebody to account when they cross the line, if you agree that they cross the line, then what is it? What kind of signal does it send for everybody else? You're not really serious about what you say is important to you. You're not really serious about being shown a lack of respect. You're not really serious about removing your support from people who may affiliate with the same party, but who now you know in their heart think you're less than. It's the same conversation we had about the Italians crying about Pritzker and Lightfoot not showing up to their party.
Well, yeah. Well, Lightfoot would have been booed off of the street.
I'm sure Pritzker would have been too, but that's not the point. The point is, now they're showing you a lack of respect. Well, you're pretending. They've shown you nothing but disrespect from start to finish, start to present. And so is the same with Pritzker. If you don't hold people to account who behave like that, you're going to get more people who behave like that because you've demonstrated that they can take you for granted. And it's remarkable to me how people will play that lesser of two evils game to support people who think that they are dumb, that they are inconsequential. And that's what these politicians are telling you. Michael on the South Side.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. One of the reasons why I'm so skeptical about the civil rights activist crowd is that they play this game of selective outrage. They said nothing when the tapes about Pritzker came out. They said nothing.
Some said something, but yeah, others did not. It was divided, no question.
Yeah. How about the blackface governor in Virginia? I'm still waiting for the march on that one.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Michael. Appreciate it. Susie, Northside.
Hey, Dan, wasn't Robert Byrd, Senator Robert Byrd, a senator, and Biden and Hillary loved this guy? And he belonged to the KKK.
Yeah, he was a recruiter. Right. Yeah, thanks for the call, Susie. It's worse than that. When he got elected to the U.S. Senate, Barack Obama sent out a fundraising request on behalf of Robert Byrd. You know, doing a little recruiting for the Ku Klux Klan, as long as you're a Democrat and you're going to spread money around and play some games of tokenism with respect to the black community, then that's good enough. That's good enough for some, not all. We're going to see. We're going to see about this. You know, this is why elections are instructive. We're going to see who's serious about accountability and who isn't. Who's serious about looking at things eyes wide open and who isn't.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Uzma Sharif is the owner of Chocolat Uzma. That's a good name.
Chocolat.
I like that business. Chocolat. Chocolat. I used to love the movie with Johnny Depp and Juliette Binoche. Chocolat. Chocolat. Uzma Sharif, Chocolat Uzma owner. She has her business in Pilsen. Mm-hmm. She went on with Neil Cavuto to talk about what it's like to try to operate a business in Pilsen in Chicago.
Let me guess. Crime was an issue?
The upshot is that she'd like to stop operating her business in Cook County.
Well, we are basically tired of the high crime in Chicago, the lack of police. The police are not happy with the mayor, and we have to pivot our business, and we've had to reduce our hours. Basically, we're moving to the suburbs. We're trying to get out of Cook County.
Wow. Escape from Cook County. As a regular Snake Plissken is Uzma Sharif, owner of Chocolat. Uzma, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's not just the crime.
It's not only the crime, but it's also the politics. Their officers are very unhappy in Cook County. The citizens of Cook County that we've lived here for all our lives, we're unhappy. We can't even walk down the street without looking over our shoulder. My friends are getting carjacked while doing deliveries for their businesses. Another friend of mine was attacked at her shop. So it's basically Cook County. Everybody in Will, DuPage, Kane, they're very happy. The police over there are very happy, and the citizens are well protected.
For now. Yes, for now, Safety Act, Pritzker Purge Law. You thought I was going to go there. You're correct. Yeah, for now. It's interesting to get a perspective from the business owner. Here's what she sees in her neighborhood, talking to fellow small business owners, neighbors, obviously. And here's what she thinks the case is in the suburban counties, because it has been, because crime is taken a lot more seriously by the suburban prosecutors, other than maybe El Reinhardt in Lake County. But certainly Berlin and Glasgow and Eric Weiss, who we had on the show in Kendall County, and taken more seriously. So they prosecute criminals. They hold people over for trial. They are serious about removing repeat violent offenders from society for a long time. That's not the case with Kim Fox, Lori Lightfoot, Tim Evans, Tony Preckwinkle, Tom Dart. We understand. But that all changes if the Pritzker Purge Law goes into effect, because you, instead of handcuffing the prisoners, you've handcuffed the prosecutors and the judges and the police in the collar counties. Is this penetrating? I know it's penetrating for anybody who listens to this show, because we spend a good deal of time on it. I hope it's penetrating within your circles of influence. Because if it's not, I don't know what to tell you. But Uzma Sharif offered this nice little turn of a phrase.
Life is very short. City of Chicago has become Gotham City, except we don't have the Batman.
Wow.
Gotham City without the Batman. Pretty good. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
It's sad, but people are like, can we throw up the bat signal? We need help.
Something else that she said is important. So she's clearly not afraid to speak out. She's clearly been having conversations with people who are similarly situated in Pilsen, perhaps elsewhere. And so what has she heard back from the city? The same thing that McDonald's CEO Chris Kaczynski heard back? He should educate himself before he starts talking about crime in the city. This is what Lori Lightfoot said to him. Said, you know, not to him directly, said in response to his comments about crime being a problem in the city, he should educate himself before he starts spouting off, said Lori Lightfoot. Well, that's better than Miss Sharif has gotten.
And the lack of communication that we've received from the mayor's office, from the city in general, it tells us what's going to come ahead of time in, say, 6 months or a year. This problem has been progressing since 2020, and we're at 38% crime rate in the city of Chicago.
Just incredible, but still no reaction. Maybe if you can do me a favor, and when you do get a reaction, you deserve one, please let us know. But good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I think she's going to get that reaction. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Neil, you'll be well into your retirement before a small business owner gets a reaction from this political power structure in Chicago. What's the reaction? I can tell you what the reaction is if somebody asked Triple Threat about it at a press conference or Pritzker.
Okay.
They give you the bromides about how crime is a serious problem
and it's down.
Everybody deserves to be safe and we're doing all we can and there's more work to do, but we're doing the work. And yeah, we're making progress, but I understand it's not good enough, but we're serious about it and so on and so forth. And we love our small business people and so on. And
we need our small businesses to thrive and about equity and about, that they're there for them.
Yeah.
They care.
Right. I'm particularly concerned about people of color and neighborhoods of color like Pilsen. All of the, you know, identitarian cant that you've become so accustomed to. And how does that work in terms of keeping people safe? Feel good about it? You're not going to get any direct communication. She'll shine you on because, just as, and this is what they all do. The little person, like an Uzma Sharif, oh, we appreciate her concerns and we take them very seriously. Anybody who's punching above Lightfoot's weight class, like the CEO of McDonald's, hey, shut up. That's what the response is. Hey, knock it off. Otherwise, I'll find ways to mess with you. I mean, it's sort of the implied threat. And that threat is not to be taken seriously, which is why so many of these C-suite executives and others are not to be taken seriously. They use the threat of retribution from City Hall as a cover for their cowardice. This is, you know, people are pretending that this is still the days, the glory days of the machine, like Richard J. Daley is still in charge. He's not. The machine is not. Stop lying to people and stop lying to yourself. Uzma Sharif has more political courage than most of the attendees to all of those economic club fets in the city where C-suite executives talk to each other. More political courage than all of those tax-eating parasites at the city club where socialists talk to each other. This city rises or falls on Uzma Sharif and men and women like her. Do we understand that? And the reason it's falling is because you've driven out middle-income families. You've driven out those who are upwardly mobile economically, who play by the rules, who are self-sufficient. You've driven them out. Black, white, Latino, you're driving them out. And you've driven a whole lot of wealth and a whole lot of productive capacity out of the city. And what do those people get from the city? Pat on the head, if any communication at all. And then people that are actually in positions to drive change, they stay silent. No, that's sort of how a banana republic works. And so that's the situation in Chicago and so many other big cities, which is why this is an issue that is running neck and neck with inflation in terms of informing people's choices on November 8th. And stories like this, Washington, D.C., just so I make the point again that this is a mentality. This is a ideology. It's not limited by geography. Washington, D.C., the Metro Transit Authority says free riders are committing a criminal offense if they're in the Virginia, Maryland suburbs that surround the Capitol and don't pay for their trip in. But the problem is the D.C. City Council decriminalized fare evasion. Within city limits, fare dodgers face a $50 civil citation. In the old days, they might have been staring down a $300 fine and 10 days in jail. Here's the statement from the Metro Transit Authority. Tickets are provided by each jurisdiction, and until recent action in the district establishing an adjudication and appeals process, Metro did not have tickets to use in the district. Therefore, Metro didn't have the ability to issue fare evasion citations in the district. So this is the capital city of the world's richest and most powerful country, and they can't stop people skipping fares because they don't have tickets, they say. Riders have skipped payments on some 9 million bus trips, or 34% of total bus trips. That is up fourfold from 4 years ago. And what's being done about it? Nothing. So what's happening? More of it. you know, I get bored having to repeat myself, as you probably get bored having to listen to me repeat myself. But this is like linear. This is not a complicated equation to solve. Willpower. Political willpower. Just a little bit of courage. Just a tiny bit of Uzma Sharif's courage.
She's well-spoken, too. She's a good face for this.
Well, she's a chocolatier. Matt on the south side.
Hi, Dan. I just had a question. I was wondering, you know, we have all this talk about funding the police and defunding the police. And I guess my concern is everybody's focusing on the funding, but it seems like no matter what happens, once something goes wrong, like everybody's tying the police's hands. And I don't see that changing, and I don't know how that's going to change. My whole thing is if we have more officers on the street, what good is it if every time something goes wrong, everybody's out there rioting and all that stuff? I mean, it just seems like everybody's talking about funding the police, but nobody wants them to actually do their job.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Matt. This is what Uzma Sharif was talking about, too, and said the morale in the police department, they can't do their job. Talked about it a lot. What? How does it change? Well, it doesn't change if you have the same people or different people with the same philosophy in charge. It will not change. It seems to me, and this is not being critical of Matt, but we're always looking for a way, some people, the people that rationalize staying the course. What if we do this? And what if we do that? We're always trying to work around the problem rather than address it head on. It's a personnel problem and a political philosophy problem. And, of course, the two are linked. Can't we figure out a way to make Lightfoot do this? Can't we figure out a way to make Pritzker do that? How about you figure out a way to remove Lightfoot and Pritzker? Isn't that easier? That just takes a vote. How about you take a political risk and you get outside your comfort zone because your comfort zone isn't so comfortable anymore?
Nope.
How about you try something in this city and state that has not been tried in my lifetime?
When was the last time we had a...
Because everything else produces the same results, at least for the last 50 years. And it's not even RD. It's just like a different philosophy, different political willpower, a different governing coalition that will back a different approach to things like personal safety. How do we work around the principles? You don't. How do we work around the political ruling class? You do not. You cannot. It doesn't work that way. You have to send the message that you will hold them accountable for a failure or worse. You have to remove people.
Don't reward them. But people are scared and they're complacent. I've been hearing. I went with a group of ladies and they're all crime is so bad and it's
right.
Well, do something about it. You don't have to keep voting for the same idiots.
Right.
Like, oh, but they'll take our abortion rights away. Like, no, they're not. And you just sit with them and explain it to them.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
And they Google you, and then you have to leave.
Good morning. Well, you know, one of the things that's going to take a lot of people in the machine's political base out of their comfort zone is this inflation, if it just keeps going on, because that's going to ruin the value of these pensions. It's not just about the inflation, the cost of living going up. Once those pensions lose their value, I mean, if you're only getting a COLA of, and it's somewhere between 1.5% and 3%, depending on the plan and so forth. If you're only getting that COLA, you have inflation of 7-8%. You start to look out over the horizon and what your pension is going to be worth in 10, 20, whatever number of years it is. It's not very good. So as those pensions lose their value, that will destroy the Democratic coalition. The market is basically coming to bear on this if it continues in this way. Mm. The pensions were always such a golden gift to all the different public city workers because the inflation was low and their COLAs and their raises were higher. They had real wage increases, but they're going to be staring down negative real wage increases every year and pensions that aren't worth as much. That'll affect them politically, I think.
Thanks for the call, Frank.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Tickets are on sale now for Freedom Summit 2022. Get yours today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The parental revolt against these new Marxists on school boards and in positions of authority generally continues. Dearborn, Michigan, Dateline. Dearborn, Michigan has a sizable Muslim population, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And there was a sizable Muslim contingent of Muslim parents at the Dearborn school board meeting. They were there in part to talk about the offerings in the library, the grooming literature present in their library. And they were treated by the school board president and other school board members in the same heavy-handed way we've seen parents treated by school board members around the country over the last 3 years. The board president told the audience to conduct themselves as adults. We will not boo. We will not jeer. You can clap if you like, and you'll listen to the speaker.
Oh, really? Wow.
Oh, really?
Jeez.
Another tyrants. Another school board member, our librarians and educators have been attacked by some members of the public and labeled as sexual predators and groomers. This is insulting and disrespectful and libel. No, it isn't. This is a serious accusation, undermines our educators and libraries. No, what undermines your educators and libraries and your school board is your indifference to the concerns of parents and to the choices you're making about literature in libraries and books as part of the curriculum, the actual education that is or is not going on within the school walls, and whether it trends toward leftist indoctrination and separation of children from their parents in the process. Led by a father named Hassan Awan, this is how the school board meeting broke apart.
More important, and I'm the one that's going to send a message to everybody. We are not going to tolerate this. The school board to walk out.
Vote them out! 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 Vote them out!
Took it to the streets. Vote them out! Vote them out! Vote them out! Hopefully that is a chorus that continues to, I don't know when the school board elections are in Michigan, but here to the spring elections. Yeah, vote them out. Dad standing up. Nice to see.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yesterday,
if parents don't fight for their children, nobody is going to fight for their children. That is the bottom line.
And we just go right around the infield when it comes to these cultural and moral issues. Yesterday, there was a press conference in Illinois, Zoom press conference, that was hosted by outgoing state legislator Tom Morrison, Republican from Palatine, Illinois Right to Life Executive Director Amy Gerke. And it featured a woman from Virginia, a mom, named Eileen Roberts. The topic was on the repeal of the parental notification law in Illinois under Governor Pritzker. He did that so that parents do not need to be informed if they're minor daughter is going to have invasive surgery, also a parental rights issue, like the nature of the child's education. Here's Eileen Roberts sharing her story about living in a state, Virginia, without a parental notification law.
When my daughter was 14 years old and she became severely depressed, we thought that perhaps her boyfriend had introduced her to drugs. But instead, we didn't find drugs. We found a questionnaire from the abortion clinic that she forgot to mail back to the abortion clinic. Because of her depression, she was hospitalized for 7 weeks. And during that hospitalization, it was determined that her abortion was done incomplete. So I rushed to the hospital because she couldn't have that follow-up surgery unless I signed a consent form to have the surgery from an abortion that I didn't even have to be notified about. And to add insult to injury, our family was responsible for the follow-up costs in the amount of $27,000. So this would just help parental notification in every state. What it does is it gives parents the right to know that their daughter is having a secret abortion, that their friend or a predator is secretly taking them to a clinic and then having an abortion and sending them home. We hear this horror stories about incest and rape, but what we do in this country, again, is we give our daughters secret abortions and then we send them back home to the abuser. When these abusers and predators need to be convicted of the crime and brought to justice. So this is an important legislative policy that every parent across the board, on the other side of the aisle, independents, Republicans, and Democrats, every parent has the right to know.
It's a helpful reminder that if a minor girl is pregnant, a crime has been committed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
have we forgotten that?
Know. Yeah, we have forgotten that. That's why people think we're going to be the, you know, human sex trafficking capital state.
So
any human trafficker can just bring a 12, 13, 14-year-old girl to an abortion clinic in Illinois. No one's going to ask, who got you pregnant? Why are you pregnant? They don't care. They just want to give you an abortion.
That's the Brooke Bellow story.
Yeah.
As well.
You're right. Yep.
And so I'm sorry, who are the extremists again? Is it Eileen Roberts, the mom you just heard from? Or is it the pro-abort ideologues like those at Yahoo Finance? Headline, America is facing a diaper crisis and the anti-abortion movement is making it worse. The diaper crisis. That's the problem. The killing of children, not the problem. In fact, the lack of killing children is making the diaper crisis more pronounced. That's where we should be focused. Do you appreciate the sickness of this sort of reporting? Are you getting a sense of the depth of the cultural fight before us when it comes to protecting children from the womb to the schoolhouse and beyond? I know one gentleman who appreciates it. He's Bishop E.W. Jackson. And he and Pastor Corey Brooks are hosting a Save the Children conference at Pastor Brooks's New Beginnings Church this Saturday, October 15th in Chicago. That's where New Beginnings is, Southside. 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Save the Children conference, New Beginnings Church this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we're pleased to be joined by Bishop E.W. Jackson. Bishop, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what your agenda is for Saturday with this conference.
Well, it's clearly consistent with what you have just been saying. I really believe there's an all-out assault on the lives of children, either to control them or to destroy them. And I think it's because the movement behind it is godless. And there's no limit to the depth of depravity to which people will sink without God. And they've just decided that children are either usable or expendable. And in our case, what we're focused on is the fact that 299 innocent children have been murdered in the streets of our cities or in their homes since the riots and the defund the police movement started, which was supposed to be bringing social justice. In fact, it's getting a lot of innocent children killed, and nobody is really connecting the dots. I mean, we know that things are bad in Chicago. We know things are bad in Philadelphia. We see these eruptions in cities, but we don't realize this is a nationwide epidemic in which children are being murdered to the tune of about 10 a month. And we're talking about the most horrific situations where kids are shot dead in their sleeping in their beds, shot dead playing in their living rooms. We have one child here in Richmond shot dead, sitting out on a stoop with her mother, 3-month-old baby, and the mother gunned down in a shootout between some thugs who didn't care who got killed. Most of these murders, as you all know, are unsolved. And the violence is just really wreaking havoc on these communities. And we want to point that out in this conference and talk about some real solutions to the problem.
Well, you can address the fact that here in Chicago, a lot of kids are murdered because their parents or their father or mother, or mostly the father, is a gangbanger. And, you know, in the middle of the day, a girl would get shot while she's in her car, you know, waiting for a Happy Meal at McDonald's. So how would you want to approach that as part of the problem?
Oh, there's no question that that's part of the problem. But we also want to point out that in some cases, in many cases, these children have neither they nor their parents have anything to do with gangbanging, with violence. And even so, the children are still innocent victims.
Oh,
I mean, for example, the child killed in Atlanta, Sequoria Williams, she was in the car with her mother trying to navigate around a Black Lives Matter barricade, and they took this as some kind of effort to breach their protocol, fired into the car, and killed the child. I mean, so in many cases, you know, these kids even their parents are not doing anything wrong. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or frankly, living in the wrong neighborhood where this stuff tends to break out, although it's spilling out all over the place now. But we want to focus on the children. As part of that, you say, how do we approach that? Look, we've got long-term and short-term approaches to this, but the long-term approach, let's face it, is we've got to focus on rebuilding families, because the kids who are doing this are products of single-parent, female-headed households. Often the mother's too young and has not finished raising herself, let alone capable of raising a child, especially a boy who can be matriculated into the gang culture, the street culture, and often becomes, frankly, just a threat to everybody around him. So we've got to deal with that. But choice in education, to give these kids educational opportunity. Nationwide, 87% of Black kids graduate functionally illiterate from high school. And those are just the ones who manage to graduate. So what else is there if we're not even educating them to learn to read and write? So we need to give parents some choice and some educational opportunities for their children. And then, of course, we've got to rebuild the relationship between police and the community, because this notion that the police are the enemy, said, well, you know, now that you've got police defunded, you've got them having recruitment crises, they're retiring, they're resigning, there are fewer police to man their jobs, and now we've got this epidemic of violence. How's that working out for us? If the police were the problem, it sounds to me like the police weren't the problem. The police were the solution, and we now have undermined the solution to this violence.
Something else, too, that we were talking about, and I see it on your agenda, too, attempts to push the LGBTQ agenda on children in public schools, CRT, the incessant racial ideology and demagoguery of the left. You know, this whole... to me, it seems like a misdirection play or a loyalty test that the left imposes on everybody, but particularly minority kids and minority families. You know, you got to go along with stuff that runs afoul of your values, what you think makes sense. And we're talking specifically, for example, about boys playing girls' sports or minors, being able to mutilate themselves without parents even being notified, much like with abortion. It seems to me that a lot of Black families have to be uncomfortable with this, but are afraid to reject it publicly and say no because their schools are going to be negatively impacted, or because these are the people they're otherwise affiliated with, the teachers' unions and the left?
Well, look, I think Black parents are objecting, but very often they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sure where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And look, you are absolutely right. You got kids not being taught to read, but they're being taught these bizarre, perverse sexual ideas about their identity. And look, Black parents are incensed about this. I've talked to many of them. They are incensed about this. But they need to be given a voice. They need some leadership. And I think we're going to see that emerging in the coming elections for school board in these black communities, where people have just, they're just fed up with this idea that they have no say over the education of their children. And we know there's some parents here again, but the home is dysfunctional in some cases. But there are a lot of parents who are trying to get their children educated, and they're finding the government schools are failing by the numbers.
How has the impact of inflation affected the average working American?
Oh, my goodness. Look, it's devastating. It is really devastating. I'm a pastor. Pastor Corey, of course, is a pastor. We're going to have a lot of pastors at this meeting on Saturday. All of us are counseling and working with our members because they're facing the high food prices, the high gas prices, and it's devastating their budgets. I mean, if you're not wealthy, if you're not very affluent, this stuff is really cutting deeply in, and people are having to make choices
yep.
that they didn't think they would have to make. So, yeah, that's a whole nother issue that my organization gets into, sort of separate and apart from this one, from the issue of these children being murdered. But it's just another big pressure on these families and, frankly, on some of these kids in the streets to do what we see them doing, which is just take what you want and ignore the system, which is only too happy, it seems, to cooperate with that.
Well, Bishop E.W. Jackson, if you can overcome your Harvard education to be a sensible person, then there's hope for everyone. Bishop E.W. Jackson.
Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, clearly. Bishop E.W. Jackson, he is Harvard educated. He's also a lawyer in addition to being a minister out in Virginia. He's the founder of STAND, Staying True to America's National Destiny, and host of The Awakening, which is a national radio talk show on the American Family Radio Network. The conference this Saturday, Bishop E.W. Jackson, Pastor Corey Brooks, as he said, many other pastors will be there. Save the Children Conference, New Beginnings Church on Chicago's South Side this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Bishop Jackson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Just to do a little bit of a flashback, last week, Harris Faulkner, Fox News, did a good piece about her trip to the border, including she went to Eagle Pass, Texas, right there on the border. She spoke to a rancher named Noah Silva. You'll hear that exchange in just a second. Here's what Harris Faulkner saw when she got down there.
People come. They change out of their wet garments. They leave. And I mean, when I tell you there's personal stuff here, I mean personal feminine hygiene products, everything all over the ground. It's unbelievable how easy it is to cross that river. This gate is wide open right now because we don't have enough people. So many people have come across today. There's no Border Patrol. There's no National Guard at this point. This is humanity that's coming across a river point into Eagle Pass, Texas. And the citizens here are our first line of defensive information about it. People spend a lot of money on alarm systems for their houses. But for some reason, Washington can't hear the voices of the people in Eagle Pass. And their alarm is for free.
And Noah Silva, who works for a ranch that's right there on the border, what he's seeing now versus what he's seen up until now in the many years he's worked on this ranch?
It's 100,000 acres with miles of perimeter chain that the owner has put up over and over. People's dreams, livelihoods, and homesteads are under threat.
When I got here almost 6 years ago in November, I didn't see any illegals. Every now and then I might see one or two together. That was it. Now it started from 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, and it went up and up and up. Now, those are the ones that were caught. How many made it all the way through? It's hard to say.
Is it daytime, nighttime?
24/7. It's 24/7.
24/7. Virginia Allen is a senior news producer for the Daily Signal, co-host of the Problematic Women podcast. She joins us now with what she saw on her trip to the border. Virginia Allen, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you this morning. Thanks for having me.
One of the things that you wrote about at the Daily Signal about this, talking to people down there, including law enforcement, there's those who want to get caught and those that do not want to get caught. Sort of interesting. I mean, I think I can fill in the blanks to some extent, but what does the local sheriff you talk to mean when he says, when he categorizes the migrants in these two groups?
Right. So you have those, like those that Harris Faulkner said that she saw, that come across the Rio Grande, often in groups, sometimes family groups, sometimes friend groups, and then they wait for Border Patrol to come and pick them up. These are individuals who want to claim asylum, and they want to be put into the system that the Biden administration has created, where you claim asylum, some basic information is taken down, and then ultimately you're given a bus ticket, a plane ticket to go somewhere within the interior of the United States, you know, told to contact an ICE office for an asylum hearing. Maybe you show up to that. In all likelihood, you probably don't, and you just put a fade into the fabric of America. So there's those folks. Then you have the bad actors. You have the individuals who want to come to America because they're smuggling in drugs, they're human traffickers, they have a criminal record. These are people that want to avoid Border Patrol. These are often very dangerous individuals, they are coming across the border in areas where they know Border Patrol is maxed and doesn't have the capacity to cover, and they're coming through people's property. Like you said, I talked to other locals, ranchers, that have those same issues of people coming across their property. I spoke to the sheriff of Kinney County, which is right next to Del Rio in Valverde County, Sheriff Coe, and he said, you know, for their small community, their whole economy is built on hunters and it's built on ranchers. And when ranchers can't keep their livestock in pastures because illegal aliens keep cutting the fences, that land becomes useless to them. And how long do you think they're going to stay in those communities when literally their very livelihood is being taken away from them because of the actions of illegal aliens? And that affects the whole community, obviously. But in this situation, it really is hitting those who live on the border first. It's very rapidly making its way to a community near you.
So what's happening to these people? I'm watching, you know, through your article that you wrote at dailysignal.com, you shared some video that a neighbor took of people just meandering through the streets. Where are they going? Because I'm under the impression that once you cross the border, you have to surrender.
Well, so there's so many crossing areas that the Border Patrol just doesn't have the capacity to patrol at all times, right? Mm-hmm. So that woman who you mentioned, Teresa Esther Chapoy, she was so kind and took a lot of time with me, one of my colleagues, and just kind of shared what it's like to live 1 mile from the border. And she sent me that video and she said, you know, this is really common for illegal aliens to just walk down my street. And those people were looking for Border Patrol. They had just crossed and they were just, you know, kind of going to keep on walking until they happened upon Border Patrol or someone called Border Patrol for them. Those are the individuals who want to be found, want to be discovered. But for someone like Teresa Esther Chapoy, who lives so close to the border, she's had to take some pretty extreme measures to feel safe in her own home. Because while she does have all of those illegal aliens kind of crossing in front of her house who, you know, maybe those are not dangerous folks. They have good intentions in mind. She also has plenty of individuals crossing through her property who are not safe people. They do not have good intentions. So in order to feel safe in her own home, she's put up lights all over her house. She's gotten a guard dog. She put a fence in her backyard because she says, you know, it's not uncommon in the middle of the night for a bad actor who's an illegal alien to be running through a property and Border Patrol to be chasing them. And, you know, for her and her neighbors,
this is just the reality that they now have to live with.
Yeah, that really crystallizes it, too. I mean, think about that. Would you want a police chase in your backyard every night? Does that make you feel safe? I mean, it's pretty stark. Those two groups again, though. You know, it's such an interesting thing, and this has been for years, including through the Trump years, although it was much diminished compared to the numbers we're talking about now. The number of people who have committed violent crimes, who have been deported before, who wind up in the interior of America, and they commit another crime, and go through the deportation process again. So those two groups, when they're confronted, those that want to get caught, want to, you know, declare asylum, they've been properly educated, or they've educated themselves about how the system works, and you make that declaration, you get to stay on this side, maybe you hop a bus to Chicago or New York if DeSantis or Abbott has spaces available for you. But that other group too, the group of people that aren't coming here for a better life, they're coming here to prey on other people. They have bad intentions. When you talk to local law enforcement, you know, how much conflation is there between those two groups in terms of how Border Patrol is essentially compelled to handle them? How good is the system at keeping people who have criminal backgrounds out of this country? It doesn't seem like it's very good. So, I mean, to some extent, it doesn't seem like there's much difference in terms of the processing of the people that try to evade capture versus those that are here to be captured and declare asylum.
Yeah. I mean, first off, I want to say Border Patrol really is doing a good job. They are trying their best. They're just so maxed out right now.
Yeah, I understand.
Really, what you have had happen is because of the sheer numbers of people coming over, a lot of those individuals, a lot of the Border Patrol agents have actually been pulled off of their posts on the border so that they can sit in an office and process these asylum claims. And obviously that's not what they signed up for. They signed up to actually be protecting our border. But you have a system that is, it lends itself to being manipulated because, you know, an individual crosses and if they're caught, if they're apprehended, and they don't have an ID on them, they don't have a birth certificate on them, you know, they can tell law enforcement whoever they are. You know, they can say, I'm John Doe, I lost my license, I lost my identification in the journey here, and we have no way of knowing that he's not John Doe. So in cases like that, it becomes really, really challenging then for Border Patrol. Their hands are essentially tied because of the policies of the Biden administration, and they just kind of say, okay. So that really provides a loophole.
So where does John Doe? Where does John Doe go? Where do they have to put John Doe? Like you're talking about.
Well, he enters this process of claiming he can claim asylum, and he can wind up, you know, on a bus to Chicago in 2 weeks because there's no way for us to fully find out. I mean, unless he has a criminal history previously in America and we can search those fingerprints.
Right.
There's no way for us to know he's not who he says he is.
So MS-13 can send endless numbers of young men here that try to evade capture, get captured, pretend they, you know, I lost my driver's license, my dog ate my driver's license or my ID. And then they're treated just like a genuine asylum seeker.
That's right. I'll point you towards one of my colleagues from the Heritage Foundation was on this trip with me, Simon Hankinson. He just came out with a piece 2 days ago that documents kind of how this whole process could work. When we were on a ranch down in Eagle Pass, we found a discarded identification card from an individual from Venezuela. And our guide, we were with a former Border Patrol agent, Frank Lopez, and he said, oh, yeah, this is actually pretty common that individuals who don't want to be identified, that don't want to carry identifying information, once they cross the Rio Grande, they just toss out that ID card because they don't want to be identified by that name, maybe because they do have a criminal record. So that does happen.
and it's part of kind of this system of how the system essentially is being worked.
With 3 million illegal crossings under Biden's reign so far, what do Border Patrol agents say, local law enforcement say? Like, are there any simple things that can be done that would dramatically reduce the inflow and make the situation more manageable, like remain in Mexico mm-hmm. policy? What do they tell you?
Yeah, so the first step that everybody said is just the border has to be secured, and people have to know that, you know, they can't just come into the United States and be allowed to stay in the United States. You know, people talked about, you know, maybe what President Trump did wasn't perfect, certainly had flaws, but that idea of remain in Mexico was effective in the fact that illegal aliens knew they couldn't just come across the border, claim asylum, and then stay in the United States. There was an actual process that they had to go through. And because that process has been totally removed by the Biden administration, Border Patrol's so maxed out that they can't patrol the border. In other words, the border's wide open. So if we want to get the situation under control, step one is just securing the border. And of course, that can often mean finishing the wall. You know, there's huge sections. It's kind of humorous. You'll be driving along and maybe there's 3 miles of fencing. And then all of a sudden it just stops. And so, you know, unless you actually have a secure fence on the whole of the border, it's almost pointless to have any fence at all because, you know, you can just walk another 3 miles and get to an opening. And until the border is secure, I don't see that this situation is going to change.
She is Virginia Allen, senior news producer for The Daily Signal and co-host of the Problematic Women podcast. Virginia Allen, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon. It's like 2022's E.F. Hutton. Went on to that Investotainment channel, CNBC, to talk about where things stand.
People talk. If he talks, people will listen.
That's right. And he said this about the R word. We've had 2 quarters of negative growth, and he's talking about the prospect of a recession. Okay.
But you can't talk about the economy without talking about the stuff in the future. And this is serious stuff, okay? This is inflation, which obviously is, you know, changing the effect of those numbers I just told you about. It's rates going up more than people expected already, and probably a little bit more from here. It's QT, which we've never had before. So therefore, the unknown effects, and you see it today in bond markets around the world and sovereign markets and people selling U.S. Treasury debt, and it's the war. And these are very, very serious things, which I think are likely to push the U.S. And you know, the world. I mean, Europe is already in a recession, and they're likely to put U.S. in some kind of recession 6-9 months from now.
Well, the question is the depth, but one of the – and he sort of leaves that as an imponderable at this point. Although we're sort of in worst-case scenario based on some of the predictions people like him were making about a year ago. We're already there. But he is confident about one thing.
But the one guarantee, which we've been consistent about, is volatile markets. You're going to have volatile markets. You've already seen markets down quite a bit, no IPOs, very little high yield, bridge loans being hung and stuff like that, which is pretty typical, but it's still been orderly. I think it's possible you're going to see it be disorderly sometime in the not too near future.
And Amy, since you're still in the market, you like to live dangerously, you may want to pay attention to what he says about the S&P.
And I think the likely place you're going to see more of a crack and maybe a little bit more of a panic is in credit markets. And it might be ETFs, it might be a country, it might be something you don't suspect. If you make a list of all the prior crises, you're sitting here, we would not have predicted where they came from. So I think you can predict this time that it probably will happen. And so if I was out there, I'd be very cautious. If you need money, go raise it.
What about stock markets? Where do you see the trough for the S&P 500?
Oh, I don't know. No, okay. It may have a ways to go. I mean, it really depends on that soft landing, hard landing thing. And since I don't know the answer to that, it's hard for me to answer that. but it could be another easy 20%. And I think like the next 20% will be much more painful than the first. Rates going up another 100 basis points will be a lot more painful than the first 100 because people aren't used to it. And and I think negative rates, when all is said and done, will have been a complete failure.
Well, it's interesting. He says that negative rates will be a complete failure because he was asked to rate the performance of Jay Powell and the Fed, and he was apparently grading on a curve.
In hindsight, they waited too long and did too little, and QT should have started sooner and all that. But they're clearly catching up. They're clearly motivated to catch up. And, from here, let's all wish them success and keep our fingers crossed that they manage to slow down the economy enough that it doesn't, to cause it, whatever it is mild. And it's possible. I wouldn't take that off.
Yeah, anything's possible, but keeping your fingers crossed doesn't sound like much of a strategy from somebody who's the CEO of the biggest bank in the world. Steve Moore joins us now, economist, Govzilla author, Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy and Our Freedom, You Don't Say. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning. And, just to connect the dots, I think your audience gets this, but I want to make sure people understand that we had around the world, not just in the United States, Dan and Amy, but around the world since 2020, somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $22 trillion of additional government spending. Now, this was the term they used for this, Dan, was stimulus. I've got air quotes, stimulus. Folks, government spending is bad for the economy. It's not good for the economy. And the chickens are coming home to, I don't say this with any joy. It's just, it was so predictable that if these fools in, these political fools and the central bankers understood basic economics, they would realize that if you're going to spend $22 trillion, you're going to cause a global financial crisis. And that's exactly what we're in right now.
Well, and here's,
they won't stop the spending, man. They won't stop.
Yeah, here's the thing. I understand past performance is no indicator of future performance. However, Jamie Dimon essentially says they got everything wrong to this point. We're on uncharted territory with quantitative tightening, but let's cross our fingers. That doesn't inspire a lot of confidence that they're going to stick the landing.
Well, look, let me just be crystal clear about this. This isn't complicated. If you want to stop a global financial crisis, governments around the world have to cut government spending. Government spending is the new virus, right? And they won't do it. And so the idea that you can just keep raising interest rates as a way to counteract this massive increase in government spending just compounds the problem. Look, I do think the Fed needs to raise rates, but they don't have any choice because of the decisions that were made. And by the way, Trump is not, without blame here, or the Republicans are not without blame. They like to spend money too.
Totally.
We spent a lot of money under Trump, and then Biden comes in and triples down and spends another and borrows another $4 trillion. Why is there inflation? Why are we in a financial crisis? I mean, come on. If I sound a little angry, I am. Because every time we've tried, quote, fiscal stimulus, it always ends badly. Have you noticed that, Dan?
I have noticed that. And you're totally right about Republicans. And here's the other thing, that these central bankers that were deferring so much authority, these mystics, I mean, the gall of the IMF to be talking about stormy waters ahead
exactly.
when they're mau-mauing Liz Truss for moving to cut taxes.
Exactly.
These central bankers, when did they become like our unelected financial czars, right?
Well, there's a great piece, by the way, I was literally just reading a half hour ago, a great piece by Judy Shelton, who was actually nominated by Trump to be on the Federal Reserve Board, and the left shot her down. But she basically makes exactly that point that you did. These unelected central bankers act like they're running the world. And, I think that's kind of a dangerous thing. And the Bank of England, president is acting like he's some kind of a king of England. And so we have too much money, too much borrowing, too much government spending, and they have to cut back. And they simply will not do that, and they keep living illusion. By the way, if the economy does crash from here, and I think it could, I think we're in real danger. I'm with Jamie Dimon on that. What are they going to do, Dan? Are they going to spend another $2-4 trillion?
Well, that's their what does the modern monetary theorists do? That's their hammer. Every problem's a nail. To every problem, you
that's
just
true.
Print money.
So, Stephen Moore, what do you do? Do you get out of the stock market? Do you cash out your 401k?
you know, cash it out.
I mean,
you
take it out. I'm saying
you, go to cash.
I mean, it's too late for that. I mean, and no. I'm not saying the market can't go down more, but I would not. You're selling low if you do that. And again, the market may still go down. I mean, Jamie, what are you saying?
Right off the losses.
20%. Yeah, that would be pretty catastrophic. Now, we lived through this in the 1970s, by the way, where the stock market lost over half of its value adjusted for inflation in the 70s. I don't know if you're, a lot of people listening to the show weren't even born in the 1970s. But so a bear market can last a long time. But I think, you know, what we have to do as Americans, we have to get rid of these people.
No kidding.
Who put us in this position in the first place.
Yeah, there's a novel concept. Gas prices.
I'm talking about at the ballot box, by the way. I'm talking about the ballot.
Yeah. Less.
I don't want to be accused of hate speech.
Right. Yeah. The Steve Martin, the Steve Moore hit squad. Right. Gas prices, since they're ticking up, and most notably in California, where they're like $100 a gallon or something. Gavin Newsom calling a special session to address the high gas prices. You know what the problem is? Greed and manipulation. And he's talking about a new tax on oil industry profits. Well, that drew a response from Valero's CEO, Valero's vice president, Valero Energy. Vice president Scott Fulwarko, and this James Freeman in his Best of the Web column has it. We have been endeavoring to keep our refineries at full production, and no one has produced more low-carbon renewable fuel for the California market than Valero. Nevertheless, the market has been very tight. As to separation between California prices and the prices in the rest of the United States, we can offer the following information. For Valero, California is the most expensive operating environment in the country and a very hostile regulatory environment for refining. California policymakers have knowingly adopted policies with the expressed intent of eliminating the refinery sector. California requires refiners to pay very high carbon cap and trade fees and burden gasoline with cost of the low carbon fuel standards. And he goes on to basically say you have the most aggressively hostile environment for producing what you want us to produce. And you're surprised the prices are higher here.
So, I mean, well said. I mean, I'm glad that a corporate executive would stick his neck out and say that.
No kidding.
But he's exactly right. And I don't know that gentleman, but he's got it exactly right. Now, by the way, if you think it's bad in Illinois, what are you paying there, Amy, these days for gas?
Well, it jumped 32 cents overnight. It's about $5.36 right now, the place I go by.
In the city.
Wow. Yeah. And in the suburbs, it's teetering
like 480, 490.
Yeah, if you're, 40. Okay, if you're lucky.
You know what it is? You know what it is in California right now?
$7.
In some markets, it's like $6.89, knocking on the door of $7 a gallon. Now, that's, if you take that relative to the national average, which is high already, but the national average is $2.50 less than the California price of gas at the pump. And that is all a result of all of those regulations and all of those anti-carbon policies that California has put in place. And they've got a lot of nerve. I mean, I was laughing when you were reading that quote because, you know, for Gavin Newsom, say, gee, where did all these high gas prices come from? When everything he's done is try to stick a knife right into the back of the oil and gas industry. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah. So we get PPI and CPI today and tomorrow, respectively. Where do we expect inflation to be? But, you know, you hear, I mean, this is anecdotal, but we talked about this a little bit on the show yesterday. And you hear from people in the trades, contractors, you hear from people in the food service business, and they're like 8.5%. Our products or the ingredients for our products, the supply, the materials for what we do, 15, 20, 40, 80% over the last year. So I don't know what anybody's talking about with this is only 8%.
8%, yeah. Well, I hazard to make a guess because I don't know. I think we'll probably be somewhere in the 8 to 9% range still. But you're right, Dan. I mean, I think I told you guys the story. I got to O'Hare Airport a week and a half ago. There's no rent-a-cars at any price. You know, there's no – try to buy a new car. If you guys tried to buy, there are no new cars. I mean, you have to wait.
Used cars are
for the privilege.
Used cars cost what new cars were.
Yeah. Used cars. The dealer said, how much will you sell your car I said, we're here to buy a car from you. You want to buy our car? So there are shortages of everything right now, which is so strange, Dan, because Pete Buttigieg said he was going to solve the supply chain problem.
Right.
But it is right. It is very serious. It is getting to be an increased problem. And you've got a bunch of nincompoops in the White House who have no idea. They act as if they can manage a $22 trillion economy. They're doing a great job of it, aren't they? You know, so it is. These are all unforced errors. And I love this quote this morning. I was just reading right before I came on by the Biden administration is mau-mauing the Saudis, you know, because they're reducing their output of oil and gas. And the Biden administration said, how dare you reduce your oil and gas supply at a time when Russia is invading Ukraine? I'm like, what other country is doing that?
How dare an enemy of the United States act adverse to our interests? What a surprise. they take advantage
of us.
Doing
it to ourselves, folks. That's the thing about this. It's all unforced errors. It's not like the hurricane that hit Florida. These are problems that were generated by our brilliant politicians.
Well, do you hear what Germany's going to do? They're going to pay. The government is going to pay everyone's gas bill in the month of December.
So this is great, by the way.
Isn't it great?
Don't you love this one? Yeah. Because, you know, if you've got a shortage of something, it makes a lot of sense to give it away for free. Right.
So you don't. You're paying for it. I'm going to set my thermostat to 72 degrees. Yeah. Why not?
Keep those printing presses rolling. That's going to make the 70s look like
it's really
child's
looking
bay.
Out well.
Well, P-Butt handled the supply chain issue about as well as Kamala handled the border, those two point people. Steve Moore, economist, author of Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy and Our Freedom. Steve, thanks.
And I called that one right.
Yeah, you did. You stuck that landing.
Yeah,
very good.
Thank you, Mr. Thanks, Moore. Steve. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Dr. Joseph Ladapo, formerly of UCLA, now the Surgeon General of the state of Florida. We had him on the show many times, and the show I used to do many times, talking about COVID policy choices during the pandemic.
You mean the Dan Proft show?
Yeah. And he
still have my T-shirt, by the way.
Wrote op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. Interesting guy. Independent thinker. Good. Well, last week, he issued a warning based on an analysis of data from Inside Florida showing a sharply higher risk of cardiac death in young men in the 28 days following the jab. Men under 40 had an 84% increased risk of death following vaccination with an mRNA shot.
What?
The analysis also found that people who received non-mRNA vaccinations, generally meaning the J&J jab, had a lower risk of cardiac death after the shots. Only the mRNA jabs were associated with more cardiac deaths. And so Ladapo wrote in an advisory, the state surgeon general recommends against males 18 to 39 from receiving the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. Those with pre-existing cardiac conditions such as myocarditis or pericarditis should take particular caution.
And then the feds raided his house.
No, not quite. Not yet, I
not
should
yet.
Say.
Okay.
Yeah, not yet. But Twitter shut him down.
Oh, my God.
That really? Happened. Of course it happened. Ladapo was on with Steve Bannon on his podcast to discuss Twitter's reaction and, you know, what it indicates more generally about where we are.
Dr. Ladapo, did the senior management of Twitter, did any of these social media oligarchs, did anybody reach out to you and ask you for the backup analytics, to ask you about your study, to ask you about anything before they took you down, sir?
Certainly they didn't reach out to me personally. I guess in theory, maybe they reached out to the office, but I've heard no such thing. But, you know, this whole, I mean, it is really almost criminal, really, in terms of how much disregard that they have for human rights. That, and I'm not talking just about Twitter, but this whole body that thinks it's okay to crush the voices of others because you don't like their message. Here's a message that this is not a message that is in our interest or in someone else's interest. This is a message in terms of the data, the information that we were providing. It's a message for people, for humanity, so that people can make informed decisions. You want to do more research? Terrific. You think you've already seen enough evidence and you think our methods are persuasive to you, that you believe that our results are great, are correct? Terrific. Like, humans, people get to make those choices, but this body of tech and other forces that come in and silence people, they don't think human beings have the right to have free access to information that they don't want them to have access to. So it's you know, Twitter, yes, but it's a huge deal.
It's a huge deal. For more on COVID response, adjusting COVID policy based on the data and science, continuing to research impact, assess consequences, make adjustments. Boy, that's revolutionary stuff. John Tierney joins us, contributing editor of the City Journal, former reporter and columnist at the New York Times, and co-author of The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning, Dan.
You've been covering and writing about this topic for the last several years. You can't be surprised by what happened to Dr. LaDapa when he broke from orthodoxy and dared to post such findings on Twitter.
Right. I mean, I might have thought that Twitter would be afraid enough of their new boss to be a little hesitant, but that apparently that didn't stop them. It still amazes me how for 2 years now the media has just been shamelessly, you know, flacking, and the social media platforms have just been shamelessly flacking for the administration policies, for the, the COVID narrative. And we keep seeing, you know, more and more evidence that the lockdowns were a mistake, that the mask mandates didn't work, that the vaccines do have these, you know, rare but serious side effects. And yet they just can't let go of it. I mean, at this point, I guess they can't admit they were wrong. But, I mean, you see a few people who are starting to say, well, you know, I was never really in favor of the lockdowns anyway. They're trying to, you know, rewrite history. But at this point, you know, as this evidence piles up and as everybody, you know, has natural, you know, virtually everyone has natural immunity now. You know, 86% of Americans under 18 have had a COVID infection. And yet we still have Fauci and the CDC saying that everybody over 6 months ought to get vaccinated and that we should be giving children boosters. You know, that's not the case in Europe. You know, European countries do not recommend booster shots for children. That, you know, some of them have actually stopped offering vaccines and boosters to children under 18 or even 50 in the case of Denmark. They said for young people, you know, the risks are not worth it. But, you know, here the media narrative just continues to be that, you know, that masks work and that we all need vaccines, as many shots as possible, including young people. That's crazy.
Dr. Zha, yesterday, the White House medical doctor said, get your fifth shot, or is it sixth, by Halloween so that you'll be ready for Thanksgiving. And he's pushing it still on kids and adults and people that are healthy that don't have any comorbidities.
I mean, if a drug company were doing this, pushing these shots that have no... I mean, as Rand Paul, the article I did for City Journal about Rand Paul's fight about this, you know, he asked Fauci, where is there any evidence, have you even studied if the vaccines provide any benefit to children with natural immunity? But they have no evidence that these vaccines reduce hospitalization or death in children. In fact, you know, the CDC hid the data originally that for adults between 18 and 49, a booster did not offer any reduction in hospitalization or death, and yet they're still telling people to take these shots that we do know have some, you know, rare but serious side effects. If a drug company were doing this, pushing a drug or a medical treatment with no proven benefit and serious side effects, that company would be facing, you know, bankruptcy, I think, you know, from lawsuits. and you know, possibly criminal charges. And yet, you know, they just go on doing this. You know, it's their the CDC director, like, you know, last year, she overruled her own committee that, you know, they were debating booster shots for adults between 18 and 49 for a certain group of them, and they recommended against it, and she overruled them. I mean, simply because the vaccine narrative is we all have to have as many shots as possible. It doesn't matter how many times you've had COVID, you still need more and more shots. It's just, I do hope that, you know, the Republicans take the majority in the Senate this year so that Rand Paul can become chairman of the Health Committee, and they can really start looking into this, because, you know, for now, the media has been completely just falling in line with the narrative.
Well, the media and Silicon Valley conspiring with, you know, COVIDians in the government. I mean, those who were in charge need to justify what they did and continue to convince people that lives and livelihoods were saved that would have been lost but for their actions. Actually, Andy Kessler had, to me, a bit of a surprising column in the Wall Street Journal, Blame Lockdowns on Silicon Valley, in which he makes the point, Silicon Valley provided the tools to lock people in their homes without completely imploding the economy. Think about it. You couldn't force lockdowns without laptop, Zoom, Amazon deliveries, cloud computing, Slack, QR codes, or Netflix. Without them, lockdowns would have lasted 2, maybe 3 weeks, tops, before the utter destruction of the economy forced everyone back to work. Instead, we took the Faucian bargain of technology, enabled year-long lockdowns because it was doable. Silicon Valley's tools became shackles, and I'm sure that isn't lost on Silicon Valley either.
Right, right. And what Silicon Valley also enabled was it was the laptop class. You know, the media, academics, bureaucrats, all that laptop class was able to keep working. And you know, there were studies that, when the lockdown started, everyone's income declined. But after a year or so, I think it was, the upper income people were actually making more money than before the pandemic. But it was the middle income people who saw the decline, and it was lower income workers, the ones who don't work on their laptops. They had a big decline in earnings. So this basically, Silicon Valley enabled the ruling class to keep going on about its work while the serfs, you know, brought them their food. And it was such unconscionable neglect of low-income workers, of children, of course, you know, who couldn't go to school. But it was okay because these journalists and these censors for Facebook and, you know, they could go on working. So they just went on enforcing the narrative.
Yeah,
and you had Peloton too, where you could keep working out in your house.
Yeah, and this is the coalition, right? It's the bourgeois and enough of the lower middle income families, particularly those that have affinity with the Democrat Party based on identitarian politics. That's what they need to keep together. As long as they can stitch that together, they've got enough to stay in control, and they've got enough to push back against any dissenting opinions, smear everybody as an insurrectionist or a COVID denier who dares to disagree. And this is how they maintain their positions, their power.
Right. And this is also great financially for Silicon Valley, because the brick and mortar businesses, you know, were being shut down. So they got to expand their market share. Excuse my cold. I'm sorry.
You better get the jab.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get your sixth jab? Is that what the problem is?
Yeah. I only had five, right?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So you write about, Rand Paul, a sort of Mr. Smith goes to Washington to Mr. Paul, you know, from inside Washington, I guess, with the same sort of attitude against the powers that be. So what if the Republicans did take control of both chambers, what do you anticipate we could get, even if you have an aggressive Rand Paul and an aggressive Ron Johnson pursuing the facts and the evidence?
Well, I mean, they would at least have a platform to do hearings. They could do, you know, some kind of study. I mean, I've written before at City Journal about how do you try and hold people accountable for these catastrophic mistakes, and it's not going to be easy because the whole public health establishment kind of went along with this. And and it'll be hard to hold them accountable. But I also think, as Jay Bhattacharya said, that the mistakes in retrospect are so obvious that you look at places like Florida and Sweden that did better than average by completely disregarding Fauciism, that it's going to be hard for them to suppress the facts. So some kind of a commission, you know, some kind of investigation, I think we can at least present these facts and force them out there.
He is John Tierney, contributing editor to City Journal, former reporter and columnist at the New York Times, and co-author of The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go have some chicken noodle soup.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You're into things like those Ironman triathlons and stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been to Kona. I've been to eight different Ironmans.
You've attended?
No, just because my husband plays. Well, you know what? Watching an Ironman is exhausting. You get up at 5 in the morning. You get done 13, 14 hours later.
Yeah. Well, it makes what Chris Nikic did all the more impressive.
Oh, I saw. I
the
cried.
First athlete with Down syndrome to complete the Ironman World Championship in Hawaii. And here's Chris crossing the finish line.
And here he comes from Florida, Chris Nikic, the first person with Down syndrome to finish Ironman Hawaii. You are Ironman, Chris.
That's a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, 26.2-mile run.
You don't got to tell me, sister.
He finished in under 17 hours.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's awesome. One other story that was disturbing but has a proper ending. There was a story that was made that got some attention because the sister of one Dennis Peake. Dennis Peake in outside of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah, he's worked at Wendy's for 20-plus years.
He was fired after 20 years saying she wrote, based on what he told him, they told me he was unable to perform the duties of a normal person's job.
Oh my God,
after 20 years, that seems curious. So anyway, there was a hue and cry as well there should have been. And the owner of that Wendy's franchise outside of Charlotte said, you know, oh, we made a mistake, protocol wasn't followed, or some such thing. She updated her post on social media. They offered Dennis his job back starting next week. My heart is overwhelmed by the support that you all have given my brother and myself. Thank you so much.
Well, and it's so bad because they were going to tell their brother that, oh, you know what, they're going to have a retirement party for him because they didn't want him to think he got fired because he's had that job doing those duties for 20 years. And so thank God common sense took over. But that manager who fired him should be fired.
Yeah, so again,
where's your compassion, my God?
People with disabilities.
Just kicked to the side.
And, their place in this world in integrating people with disabilities into larger society rather than trying to eliminate them in the womb. Rather than trying to limit what they're capable of doing. How many able-bodied people without any intellectual developmental disabilities can complete an Ironman? Yeah. Don't presume to know what the capacity of somebody else is. Yeah.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy on the Hunter laptop. This interview Brett Baer did on last night's special report with a former CIA intel officer named David Priest, who's now the publisher of the national security website Lawfare. He was one of the signatories of that now infamous letter that the Hunter Biden laptop had the earmarks of a Russian information campaign signed by 54 leading national security specialists that was bandied about by the Biden campaign, including the big guy, Mr. 10% himself, in the closing weeks of the campaign in 2020, when the Hunter Biden story came out and then, of course, was dutifully suppressed by the D.C. press corps and big tech. So let's remember
Russian collusion.
Let's remember the moment in the debate. And then we'll go to Bear's exchange with David Priest. And it was good. I mean, Bear pushed hard. But here's the moment in that debate between Trump and Biden about the laptop.
This is truly
we're talking about the issue
from hell.
President Trump, we're talking about race right now, and I do want to stay on the issue of race. President Trump,
I have to respond to that.
Please.
Because look,
very
there are 50 former national intelligence folks who said that what this he's accusing me of is a Russian plant.
You mean the laptop is now another Russia hoax?
That's exactly what
is this
that's
where
exactly
you're
what
this is
going.
Where he's
and the public bought it.
And here is Brett Baer challenging Mr. Priest, former CIA intel officer. He spent a lot of time in the FBI, maybe not enough time in the CIA. Would he like to recast his decision to sign on to this letter that was used by the Biden campaign, as you just heard? Any regrets?
So, understanding how you characterize it, but he characterized it differently and used it in a debate just days before an election.
Yeah, I'll let President Biden speak for himself. He's capable of doing that. What I'll do say that it has all the classic earmarks of a Russian campaign in the way it was disseminated and propagated through media.
Do you regret signing on to the letter?
Oh, absolutely not, because those words are still true.
Do you think
it has all the classic earmarks
of an election?
Oh, absolutely not. No, this
even
is
though it wasn't true.
No.
It had the classic earmarks, but it wasn't true.
What is not true?
That it was Russian disinformation.
That's not what we said in the letter. Read the actual letter, and we said we do not know if this is Russian disinformation.
It has all the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation.
Exactly. The difference between an information campaign and a disinformation campaign
did not get to candidate
and a
Joe
misinformation
Biden.
Campaign. It's Hold not on. My fault the if nuance. People don't look up definitions.
I know, but the purpose of the letter is to have an effect. And the nuance that you're talking about here never made it to candidate Biden because he said it plainly on a debate stage that obviously affected the dynamic, don't you think?
I would absolutely love for all news media to show nuance on all of these issues instead of racing to sound bites. And in this case, some news media raced to sound bites. That's not helpful for the American people. And I
you
really
think
wish that people.
Was helpful for the American people?
Well, instead of quoting one sentence from it, if people actually read maybe an entire paragraph, it shows
in
that we don't know if
don't
it's
think
Russian.
It affected anything?
I don't know if it affected anything.
But
we don't analyze American political
but
environments.
We're trying to.
What we were trying to do is point out that this has all the classic earmarks of a Russian information campaign, not to say it's Russian disinformation, but to say that the propagation through American media and international media has all the classic earmarks of a Russian information campaign because we've seen it over and over and over again. They love to sow these kind of divisions and exacerbate them. That's not American. That's Russian.
I got you.
Yeah.
But it ended up being a Biden information campaign because he used it in the campaign and in that debate.
I encourage you to ask him about that.
And I will. Thank you very much, Steve.
Yeah, and what you just heard from CIA intel officer David Priest is a classic CIA information campaign. Are you kidding me? This babe in the woods routine from a CIA intel officer. First of all, he contradicted himself. Do you think it had any impact on the election? No. Do you think it had any impact on the election? I have no idea. We don't do analysis of political impacts. So which is it? Which is it, Agent Priest? These guys, 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36DA, turnkey.protect. Sure, he and 49 other former intel officers and foreign policy, self-styled foreign policy gurus who signed on to that letter so that it could be made public, so that it could be used by the Biden campaign. They had no idea. Oh, hey, we said we don't know. But of course, what's the headline and what's the way that the D.C. press corps utilizes it in exactly the way that Brett Baer was getting to? And he's a former CIA intel officer. He couldn't fathom that the press corps in D.C. would not take the nuanced, textured language from the letter and provide, oh, they say this, but they caution. We don't know if it's disinformation. It just has classic earmarks. You spend the entire establishment of D.C. spends 2 years, 2.5 years, Russia, 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 as Trump said during the debate. Everything is Russian collusion. Everyone in Trump world is a Russian asset. And then he's part of this letter with all these leftist national security types. Oh, but hey, if you interpreted that as we were suggesting that that wasn't authentic, that wasn't Hunter Biden's real laptop, that was a Russian, more Russian collusion that you should dismiss. If you took that away, well, then you just didn't read my letter, and that's shame on you.
It's disgusting. And then this guy pretends to
operate. This guy pretends to operate in the interest of the American people. It's disgusting.
They're operating through their own narrative, pushing a narrative. Well, yesterday President Biden was on with Jake Tapper, and Tapper brought up possible criminal charges that his son will be facing.
The prosecutors think they could, they have enough to charge your son Hunter for tax crimes and a false statement about a gun purchase. Personally and politically, how do you react to that?
Well, first of all, I'm proud of my son. This is a kid who got, not a kid, he's a grown man. He got hooked on, like many families have had happen, hooked on drugs. He's overcome that. He's established a new life. He is, I'm confident that he is, what he says and does are consistent with what happens. For example, he wrote a book about his problems and was straightforward about it. I'm proud of him. He came along and said, by the way, this thing about a gun, I didn't know anything about it, but turns out that when he made my application to purchase a gun, what happened was you get asked the question, are you on drugs? You use drugs? He said no. And he wrote about saying no in his book. So I have great confidence in my son. I love him. And he's on the straight and narrow, and he has been for a couple of years now. And I'm just so proud of him.
Yeah, we know you love your son, but that doesn't mean he didn't commit a crime.
Pointless. Pointless interview. Same pablum he's tried to peddle before. The only reason to talk to him is
his son is facing possible charges.
No, the reason to talk to him is, what was your involvement? Your son said this, he pays the bills. What was your involvement? 10% for the big guy. Did you ever meet with Tony Bobulinski? He's a target. He should be a target for the press. He's a president of the United States. All that evidence swirling around him that comes from his son and his son's business associates, and Jake Tapper never gets around to asking him those questions?
No, he didn't.
Come on. Joe in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I guess I have a rhetorical question. How many CIA agents or execs or FBI leadership came out and said anything that the Russian hoax during the election looked like a political dirty trick? Which is what he's claiming the situation was with Biden? Is it, oh, it looked like it could be something that inures to the benefit of one party. The exact same thing was happening at the same time, and they said nothing. They're just a bunch of whores.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Dan, can you just sense the smarminess in that guy's voice? It just makes a neighborhood guy want to punch him right in the chops.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, that's exactly my point. Hey, people interpret it wrong. That's on them, those idiots. Hey, why don't you read a paragraph of the letter rather than just take one line that's fed to you by the D.C. press corps, you nitwits? Right. Okay. Yeah. That's on us. Sure. David Priest, CIA intel officer. The combination of people like him plus John Brennan, we haven't spent nearly enough time on the CIA. They haven't gotten nearly the attention that the FBI has gotten, and there needs to be some review of the CIA's prior bad acts and sort of current operation, as far as I'm concerned, as well. This whole intel law enforcement state at the federal level needs a pretty thorough once-over, at minimum. Kevin in Austin, Texas.
I wanted to comment on what Biden said about his son real quick before the other comment. Anybody who's been sober for 15, 20 years just because you quit drinking doesn't give you a medal. There's a lot of work you do after that. First of all, one of them is taking responsibility for reactions when you're drinking. Just because you're drinking or doing drugs or whatever doesn't give you, you're not absolved of what you did when you did that. That being said, on the thing of the only way to get rid of these people is to get out, get involved, and get Republicans elected. As you know, there are a lot of opportunities in Illinois. And until that happens, until there's scrutiny, until there's review of these people, they're going to continue to get away with it.
Thanks, Kevin.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
It's time for Animal Stories with Uncle Dan and Little Amy.
Dan and Amy, with apologies to Larry Lujak there. May he rest in peace. This is a disturbing animal story. We've had two of them.
Oh, no.
One was a Chicago man pled guilty to torturing Australian shepherd while working as a dog watcher in Lincoln Square. He got 4 years.
Yeah, but kill somebody and you can be out on parole. Hey-o, with an ankle monitor.
Parole? You mean?
I'm sorry. No,
you're out on EM.
EM.
Soon to be no bail. No cash bail, certainly. But then there's this other video that went viral of a guy in Lincoln Park brutalizing a dog that apparently he was going to get euthanized that day.
Well, the video was from a neighbor in Lincoln Park from September 22nd, and I watched it, and I swear to God, I had nightmares. I'm not kidding you. What he did to this dog, he would beat him up, and then he'd go bring him back to the car. It looked like he was living in his station wagon.
It was a minivan that looked eerily similar to yours.
No, it did not look like
mine.
Yeah,
it was a jalopy.
Well, whatever. So this hobo ride, he was driving around, and somebody spotted it at MedVet on California, California and Addison there. And they called the cops because they recognized the dog. They recognized the guy. And the guy was there to put the dog down because he was so badly injured from, I don't even know, years or months of abuse. But he's been arrested. So
they found the guy. They found the guy who was beating up his dog.
Yeah, no, he was at MedVet with his dog to put his dog down, and they arrested him. And he's crazy. If you watch the video too, you know that something is not right with him.
And so, what happens to the dog now? He's not going to get euthanized.
They're very protective of the dog. So I called just to see and get an update, and they just said he has severe injuries, and that's all they're saying at this time. But this poor thing, I mean, animal activists who watch this, they're going to give money they can. Can to save this dog.
It doesn't take an animal activist.
Anybody
who saw that, it was unbelievably inhumane.
Could you watch the whole video?
Yeah, I watched it.
Didn't you want to gouge his eyeballs out?
Well, he deserves to be prosecuted, obviously, but now I'm more interested in the dog. I'm sure there's somebody that would adopt the dog.
Oh, yeah, there'll be some. Yeah, the dog. There's many people who have, and they said many people have inquired about the dog.
He was so treated sweet. Badly when he was thrown out of the minivan, and then, but then he like walked back. It wasn't like he was aggressive or anything.
Well, he called him back.
Yeah, but I mean,
he know any
better, yeah, he came back. And
it just makes you sick. Because I start with animals and then they go to people.
I know we're not good at being nice to people in Chicagoland, but let's at least be good to our canine friends.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.